Welcome. Anyway, Prairie, as you know, but sometimes I think we take this for granted, aspires to be an open-hearted and an open-minded place where you are welcome no matter where you are on the journey of life, Spencer. No matter your ethnicity, no matter your gender identification, no matter your sexual orientation, you are welcome here. The offering will be used to purchase new clothing for jail inmates for Christmas. The Social Action Committee tells me that they finally got this okay from the prison chaplain. So last minute switch here. That doesn't mean we give any less, of course, but we'll be using the share of the December collection that we normally give to a local, almost always local charity, to purchase. This is more than a cue card here, Pam. Long johns, underwear, and socks for needy inmates. And we will also be writing Christmas cards to inmates after the service on December 11th and December 18th. Not today, though, but for sure on the 11th and the 18th. All right. Norman Stockwell's talk in the annex will start at, this is the Humanist Union? Everybody can go, but sponsored by the Humanist Union. Oh, Norman Stockwell, great. In the annex at 12:30, and as always, everyone is invited. And last but certainly not least, next Sunday will be a very special, all our Sundays are special here, but next Sunday will be extra special when Ken Longquist and his troupe come to entertain us with production of Old Befana. So I hope we pack this place. So there's standing room only.
So that's intergenerational?
It's yes, it's especially geared to kids.
Did not say that in the announcement.
The opening words are words of Howard Thurman. There'll be a lot of Howard Thurman words this morning. There will be a quiz in a minute, too. Christmas returns, Thurman writes, as it always does, with its assurance that life is good. It is the time of lift to the spirit, when the mind feels its way into the commonplace and senses the wonder of simple things, an evergreen tree, familiar carols, merry laughter. It is the time of illumination, when candles burn and old dreams find their youth again. It is the time of pause, when forgotten joys come back to mind and past dedications renew their claim. It is the time of harvest for the heart, when faith reaches out to mantle all high endeavor, and love whispers its magic word to everything that breathes. Christmas returns, as it always does, with its assurance that life is good. I will light the candle of fellowship this Christmas. And again, these are Howard Thurman's words, which I have somewhat adapted. I know that the experiences of unity in human relations are more compelling. The experiences of unity in human relations are more compelling than the concepts, the fears, the prejudices which divide. This Christmas, I will light the candle of fellowship, a candle that must burn all the year long. I will light the candle of hope this Christmas. Hope is the growing edge. It is the one more thing to try when all else has failed, the upward reach of life. It is the incentive to carry on. Therefore, concludes Thurman, this Christmas I will light the candle of hope that must burn all the year long. Thank you. Yes. This morning, between 10 and 11 a.m. Central Time, everyone who stands in solidarity with all those gathered with the Standing Rock Sioux in their efforts to stop the pipeline from going through their land, all of us have been asked to take time for prayer and meditation to mark this struggle. Our meditation time this morning is meant to be for a few moments of quiet to recognize what is happening out there in North Dakota and why it is so very important. As Sarah Van Gelder notes in the current issue of Yes magazine, there is much about what is happening at Standing Rock that is extraordinary. The young people, the determination to protect the water, the willingness to stand up to attack dogs and gun-wielding police, the prayer and fierce love, I love that phrase, that is at the center of the work. So let us send our thoughts and our prayers to everyone enduring the elements along the Cannonball River in North Dakota this morning during the next few moments. A Litany of Waiting by two people I happened to go to seminary with a million years ago, Unitarian Universalist ministers Judy Wells and Duane Vigeisen. Waiting for the bus, waiting for the next election. They wrote this way before November 8th. Waiting for Christmas, waiting for your teenager to come home at night. Waiting for Prince Charming. Waiting for dinner. Waiting for the light to change. Waiting for seeds to sprout. Waiting for the alarm clock to ring. Waiting for the grief to stop. Waiting for Godot. Waiting for the Novocaine to take effect. Waiting for payday. Waiting for the bad haircut to grow out. Waiting for paint to dry. Waiting for the mail. Waiting for things to get back to normal. Waiting for the college admission letter. Waiting for the coffee to brew. Waiting for death. Waiting for vacation to start. Waiting for Prince Charming. Waiting for the test results. Waiting for the other shoe to drop. Wait till your father gets home. Waiting to turn 16. Waiting to get your driver's license. Waiting for the thunderclap after lightning. Waiting for a baby to be born. Waiting for your sister to get out of the bathroom. Waiting for the Messiah. Waiting for the car to fall apart. Waiting for the war to end. Waiting in the grocery line. Waiting for a pot to boil. Just waiting. Just waiting. So much of our lives is spent just waiting. We could all add our own waiting fors to that list. I am already waiting for spring, and winter is just starting. I am waiting to see what the shape of the world will become now that a demagogue holds the office of the presidency in this country. I am waiting to discover ways of communicating with those who believe hate is a legitimate way of being. I am waiting to see whether hate is stronger than love, or is love stronger than hate. I am waiting to see if reconciliation is possible, and most of all, I am waiting for hope to return to my soul. So it seems fitting to me that this is the Advent season, capital A, on the Christian calendar. And while I no longer consider myself to be a Christian, I believe that Christianity has much to teach us and that we should never, ever, ever throw out the baby with the bathwater. I realized as I was preparing for this morning's service that I am not feeling my usual bah humbugginess way about the upcoming, or I guess we're into it, Christmas season. This year is different for me. The idea of Advent doesn't seem so foreign to me right now, a period of waiting in which we meditate, perhaps fast. We think, we reflect, all in preparation for the real work of Christmas, which, as the choir told us, comes after December 25th. I have been so angry and despondent, depressed and distressed since the November 8th election. I did not at first realize that I had entered into a period of waiting. In my grief and confusion, I rediscovered an old friend, thanks to our choir director, Barb Park. Months before the election, Barb showed me a piece of music that she had picked up at the Unitarian Universalist Musicians Network annual meeting, which just happened to be in Madison this past summer, a piece titled "When the Song of the Angels is Stilled," with, as we have said, words by Thurman and music by Elizabeth Alexander, the song that you just heard a few minutes ago. "Might it fit into any service that you are thinking about doing around the holidays?" Barb asked me. Oh, Howard Thurman. I had actually been thinking about doing a Sunday service at some point, about using Thurman's words as a means of introducing the Prairie community to this remarkable man. So here's the quiz. How many of you have ever heard of him? Howard Thurman. More than I would have expected, but very, very few hands. Wow. Eventually, we being the program committee on which I sit, Barb and the choir, settled on the first Sunday in December to celebrate Thurman's life and bring him to your attention. So here we are, and the timing couldn't have turned out better. Little did I realize then that getting together with the Reverend Howard Thurman would begin to bring me out of my dark place, my funk. It is a great honor and privilege for me to be able to tell you a little bit about him this morning. Perhaps his words and his life story will help you, too, find hope again. When times are bleak, when the darkness and gloom seem as if they will never end, when we are despondent and in despair about the state of the world, knowing that we are not alone can give us hope. Telling the stories about how those who came before us have gone forward through the darkest of times can inspire us, or maybe at least give us a reason to get out of bed in the morning. I've actually been very excited the last week about getting out of bed to read Thurman. And he wrote a lot. And his writing is, well, he lived from 1899 to 1981. His writing is, I don't know what the word is. It's somewhat difficult. It's a little stilted, but it's worth plowing through. Telling the stories of these people can energize us, even transform us, and often even provide us with much needed laughter, which is, it's true, I think, the best medicine. These people often become our honeys. I've used this phrase before. It's a phrase that Claire Fisher, one of my mentors during seminary days, often used. A honey is someone whom we respect, living or not, and admire and even seek to emulate. Someone from whom we have learned a lot and to whom we turn when life gets complicated and messy. I was introduced to Howard Thurman in the fall of 1994, my first semester at Starking School for the Ministry, which is in Berkeley, California, and that is relevant to my story. As I said in the December issue of Prairie's newsletter, I did not meet Thurman in person since he died in 1981. I did, however, meet Mrs. Thurman, Sue Bailey Thurman, and I'll have more about that in a few minutes. One of my classes that first semester, and I chose this class, was urban ministry. I, who grew up in a tiny town in Pennsylvania, I had been told that we would read the writings of Howard Thurman in this class, an experience not to be missed, though I had no idea who Howard Thurman was. And I was convinced at that moment in time that ministry would be my path to making a difference in the world. One way to do so would be to fix the inner cities, and along the way, heal racial divisions in this country. I have a streak of naivete in me, obviously. A man named Dorsey Blake taught this class. Dorsey was also the minister of a small church right in the middle of San Francisco, a city I was rapidly falling in love with, a very walkable city, as many of you may know, and I spent a lot of time going across the bay and hiking around in that city. In fact, my colleagues and friends started calling them Sandy's Forced Marches. Very few people would go with me. Thurman encouraged his student, I mean Dorsey Blake encouraged his students to attend the church, which was greatly in need of some new members. Thus did I discover the Church for the Fellowship of All Peoples, which still exists. It was the first intentional multiracial intercultural church in the United States. It was co-founded in 1944, and it was co-pastored, at least in its beginning years, by Thurman and by Alfred Fisk, a white Presbyterian minister. That, of course, was intentional. In 1944, there was a lot of racial tension in San Francisco. Japanese Americans were being sent to internment camps. Large numbers of African Americans were moving to the area to work in the defense industry. The Church for the Fellowship of All Peoples was intentionally innovative in its Sunday school classes and curriculum and in what they did during the Sunday service. Thurman talks about a summer camp that they had in 44 and 45 for pretty young kids, 6, 7, 8, 9. And he talks about taking some of the children, and in this case it was some very young boys, to museums. And so they were looking at a painting, and it was by a Russian artist, he didn't say who. And there were several children in this painting. His group, Thurman's group, Mexicans, black kids, white kids, and they're looking at it, and a little Mexican boy said, "Oh, that boy looks just like me." And one by one, each of these kids said that, pointed out somebody in that painting. Not one of the group that Thurman had, not one of them was Russian, but they said, "Oh, that little boy looks just like me." So they were trying to build on this from the get-go of this congregation being founded. Well, I tried to attend the Church for the Fellowship of All Peoples regularly, but as it so often does, life got in the way. There was a lot to do in Berkeley, not the least of which was studying. I wish that I had given more time to this amazing place, which is now a National Historic Landmark. Every time I went to the church, I was so warmly welcomed. I can still feel that warmth. It was an elderly congregation at that time in the mid-1990s, and mostly black, though the goal continued to be having a congregation that was as multicultural, as multiracial as possible. Those beautiful older black women would always tell those of us who had ventured over from Berkeley how wonderful it was to have, no, not the white folks there, which we all were. They never said that. No, they said it was how wonderful it was to have the young people. And we were all in our 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. Mostly 40s, 50s, and 60s. Danny Glover was a member of that church then, though I never met him, but I'd met his mother and a couple of his aunts. Here is a brief sketch of Thurman's life. Born November 18th, 1899, although earlier collections of his writings say he was born in 1900, but I'm going with the more recent publications that say 1899, in Daytona Beach, Florida. His father died when Howard was only 7, leaving the family, unfortunately, in poverty. Howard had to do a lot of odd jobs all his life to help support his family, or all his growing up years, I mean. One day, Thurman tells about raking leaves for a wealthy white person in Daytona Beach when a white child came along and jabbed him, Thurman, with a pin, and then said, "That didn't hurt you. You can't feel." But also, from this childhood in Florida, he writes, "As a boy in Florida, I walked along the beach of the Atlantic in the quiet stillness. I held my breath against the night and watched the stars etch their brightness on the face of the darkened canopy of the heavens. I had the sense that all things The sand, the sea, the night, and I were one lung through which all of life breathed. Well, that's been proven. But he wasn't, he was a little kid. He wasn't relying on scientific evidence. This is his mystic self shining through. One of the reasons I love him, because he has a streak of mysticism in him. So he was raised then by his mother and his mother's mother, his beloved Grandma Nancy. And as you can tell from that passage I just read, nature was very important to them. Before his father had died, he said, "My boy has read all the books in the state of Florida." Thurman was quite a reader. "My boy is going to be a college man." In 1914, there was only one public school for African Americans in Daytona. And in fact, in all of Florida, in that right before World War I, there were only three in the entire state where black children could go after seventh grade. And two of those were private. The principal of the school where Thurman went, who Thurman generally just refers to as R.H., of course noticed Thurman as a seventh grader and this young man who was doing all this reading. And so he went to the family and said he would teach Thurman one-on-one the eighth grade curriculum, which he did. Then there was one black doctor, one in Daytona, Dr. John Stocking, who said he would help pay for Howard Thurman's schooling after the eighth grade. Thurman got a full scholarship to Florida Baptist Academy, a high school for Negroes. This is a quote from Thurman. A high school for Negroes in Jacksonville, about 100 miles away. Great, right? The story's going along so well. But all that Thurman had, graduated from eighth grade and took the exams, and all that he had to pack his clothing in was an old raggedy trunk that had no handles, so he had to bind it with a rope. Well, you couldn't ship it, you couldn't take it on the train to Jacksonville unless it had handles. I think we have archaic rules. And so the man at the train station said, you can ship it though, it will cost you $3. Well, that might as well have been $300 for Howard Thurman. At this point, he had $1. He had a $1 coin in his pocket, and that was probably supposed to last him most of the year. He took his trunk, and he sat down on the steps of the station, and he started to cry. But suddenly, he heard the sound of footsteps. Thurman, of course, is thinking, well, that's the end of that dream. I guess I'm not going to college. A black man he had never seen before, dressed in work overalls, and a denim cap, was staring at him. "Boy, what are you crying about?" the stranger asked. Howard told him. The man scratched his chin, and he looked off into the distance, and he said, "If you're trying to get out of this lousy town to get an education, the least I can do is to help you. Come with me." So they went into the station. The man pulled out a little purse, pulled out $3 worth of coins, and got the trunk ticketed. And so the story, the legend maybe, goes Howard rushed to thank the man, but the man had disappeared, and he never found out who it was. But I love that story because it's such a great example of random acts of kindness. Who knows how much power they have? Eventually, Thurman graduated from Florida Baptist Academy. He was valedictorian of the class. Then he went to Morehouse, where he was again first in his class. He was also a classmate of Martin Luther King Sr. at Morehouse. Then he went to Rochester Theological Seminary, which was mainly white, but they would take a few blacks. And again, he was first in his class. We'll skip a whole bunch of years here, and as you know, he co-founded the Church of the Fellowship for All Peoples. He always wanted to go to India, and not because of Mahatma Gandhi, although that was part of it, but because of, I will butcher this name, my apologies, Rabindranath Tagore, who was a contemporary of Thurman's and had won a Nobel Prize. Well, Thurman and his wife, Sue Bailey Thurman, went to India, and they were there from the fall of 1935 to the summer of 1936, which is a pretty nice long time. Thurman found himself being asked to explain to Gandhi, he had several got to know Gandhi fairly well, and Tagore and other luminaries in India, to explain, this is a quote from Thurman, his connections to the Christianity of the slaveholders, the lynch mobs, and other white supremacists in the United States. Well, Thurman came out of that experience realizing that it wasn't Christianity that he felt decided his life or ruled his life, or however you want to put that. It was Jesus. It was the life of Jesus. So even though Thurman remained a Christian all his life, a Baptist, he still realized that he identified with Jesus, but not necessarily with Christianity. This experience in India also strengthened his belief in the universality that is at the core of all religions. So I hope from that very brief sketch I've given you some, a little glimpse into his life. But not just the particulars of his life, but also his spiritual journey. He was always concerned with what he called the life working paper of the individual and how that then played out during a person's lifetime. Well, I don't think many of us sit down and write up our life working paper, though maybe we should, and we did do it in that class. Thurman was referring, of course, to the challenge of becoming fully human, of being the best that we can be, a phrase that I always loved until I think the Army co-opted that phrase, being the best that we can be. Thurman also referred to his life, to this life working paper of the individual, as a process of actualizing potential. I really like that phrase. I don't know if it was original with him or not. It might have been. How does life realize itself in that immense creative process that Thurman believed culminated in community? Because that is where we find wholeness, harmony, integration. Key word here for Thurman was potential, which he called that which has not yet come to pass, but which is always coming to pass. All I could think of when I was reading these writings was, how can this happen without level playing fields? Which Thurman, of course, recognized. Check the time here, because we were a little late starting. Big surprise. Here is an important quote from Thurman, though. Before I get to the quote, Thurman understood that you have to be strong and confident in yourself as an individual. The uniqueness of the individual has to be realized before you join a community, or as you're joining community, if you think of a family as the first community you're part of. But once you get into community, there are different kinds of problems, because communities tend to build protective walls around themselves. Thurman said, community cannot feed for long on itself. It can only flourish where always the boundaries are giving way to the coming of others from beyond them. The boundaries have to give way to the coming of others from beyond them. I think some of Thurman should be required reading for politicians and others. And certainly if anyone had a lock on what it means to wait for justice to arrive for your community, for your people, I would say the indigenous peoples of the world and people of color have that lock. This is not a good thing. I said in the title to these remarks, it was a very long title, that this is part one of sages, seers, and superheroes. Thurman is a sage. To me, was a sage, which just simply means one distinguished for wisdom, wise through reflection and experience. He was also certainly a seer, which is a person credited with extraordinary moral and spiritual insight, and to me is a superhero. A few weeks ago, I was hiking in Red Rock Canyon National Preserve on the outskirts of Las Vegas. It was a gorgeous day. Perfect hiking weather. And I was on a trail that I've taken many, many times. I know it well. No one was around. Suddenly I heard a strange noise. Kind of a high-pitched whine. but with a rattle-like tone underneath. I was this far from putting one of my poles down on a rattlesnake. I just pulled it up in the nick of time as it was doing its snaky thing. Here's a story that Howard Thurman tells about a rattlesnake. True story. Prefaces it with this statement: there is such a thing as a general experience of life that two forms may share at the same moment in time without resistance and without threat, which was sort of like what the rattlesnake and I were doing. Thurman writes, the following experience illustrates my meaning. When I was a small boy, I went across the meadow to visit with one of my chums. I was running around the house outside when I heard a voice which came from a knock on the window pane. I looked up to see my friend's father standing in the room. As soon as he caught my attention, he motioned for me to turn around and come into the house through the front door. When I entered the room, he pointed through an open window. There I saw his baby girl, less than a year old, sitting in the sand playing with a rattlesnake. It was an amazing and deeply frightening experience to watch. The child would turn the snake over on its side and do various things with him. The snake would crawl around her, then crawl back. It was apparent that they were playing together. I was sent back into the yard to stand guard to keep anyone from coming around the house who might frighten them. For if their harmony were broken by sudden disharmony created by noise or sudden movement, there would have been violence on earth. After a while, the baby grew tired of playing, turned away, and started crawling toward the back steps. The snake crawled towards the woods on the edge of the yard. It was then that the father drew a bead on the snake's head with his shotgun, killing him instantly. It was as if two different expressions of life, normally antagonistic to each, had dropped back into some common ground, and there reestablished a sense of harmony through which they were relating to each other at a conscious level. I don't think that humans will achieve this kind of harmony with other beings in my lifetime, and I don't think that was Thurman's intention in telling the story. As a metaphor, though, it is a powerful, powerful story. A story that might prove useful at certain times. For example, right now, when we suddenly feel ourselves seemingly so far away from any kind of harmony in this country, any movement towards finding common ground. We can't put Howard Thurman into any category. If we could, he wouldn't stay there long. As I said, he was a Christian, a devout Baptist, but that wasn't all. He was a universalist with both a small u and a capital U. He was a mystic. His mysticism fascinates me because I have had mystical experiences of my own. When I knew with absolute certainty that we are one and that everything is connected. And yes, I remain a humanist. Everything is connected. Even that rattlesnake and I were connected briefly before I realized what it was. Vincent Harding calls Thurman an earthy mystic, filled with pranks and jokes, ever ready to laugh at himself, at life, and at anything else close at hand, someone who wore out younger people on walks up and down the hilly streets of San Francisco. That's the kind of mystic I want to be. Which brings me back to Sue Bailey Thurman and my meeting her. It was a Sunday evening. I can't remember now if it was that first year when I first started going to Church of the Fellowship of All Peoples, or if it was the next year, it doesn't really matter. But Dorsey Blake, the man who taught the urban ministry class, was being not ordained, but what's that other thing we do? Installed as a minister officially in this church. He had already been doing part-time work. And Mrs. Thurman had Howard Thurman's robe to put on Dorsey during the ceremony. I still get shivers when I think of this moment. And she started to put that robe on, and I swear Howard Thurman was in that robe. I felt him in that room. I wasn't the only one. That might have just been, you know, our being innocent seminarians, but it was pretty amazing. Thurman's life working paper was rooted in a belief that love will triumph over hate, that good will win out over evil. But his idea of love was not some wimpy, sappy, sentimental kind of love, but a love mixed with fierceness. Howard Thurman's life's working paper involved a lot of waiting, but not passive waiting. His life was about solidarity within community, fierceness within love. This Advent season, may we nurture solidarity and love laced with ferocity while we wait. Wait for the darkness to lift. Wait for that arc of the universe, which is song, to bend a little more towards justice and towards wholeness and harmony. The quote at the top of your order of service says, life is against all dualism. Life is one. Always against all that fragments and shatters and against all things that separate and divide within and without, life labors to meld together into a single harmony. Only within diversity can true, real, lasting community be formed. In my readings of Thurman's writings and some of his other books where he quotes, of course, other people, I found this poem by Olive Schreiner. I dreamed I saw a land, and on the hills walked brave women and brave men, hand in hand, and they looked into each other's eyes, and they were not afraid. And I saw the women also hold each other's hands. And I said to him beside me, what place is this? And he said, this is heaven. And I said, where is it? And he answered, on earth. And I said, when shall these things be? And he answered, in the future. I will end with these words from Thurman about the future and about our dreams. And this is titled, Saddle Your Dreams Before You Ride Them. Our dreams belong to us. They come full-blown out of the real world in which we work and hope and carry on. They are not imposters, no. Our dreams are our thing. They become other when we let them lose their character. Here is the fatal blunder. Our dreams must be saddled by the hard facts of our world before we ride them off among the stars. Thus they become for us the bearers of the new possibility, the enlarged horizon, the great hope. Even as they romp among the stars, they come back to their place in our lives, bringing with them the radiance of the far heights, the lofty regions, and giving to all our days the lift and the magic of stars. That's fierce love. Do we have time for a couple of comments? Well, he was in Boston. In the 50s, he was dean of Marsh Chapel. And Sue Bailey Thurman, who was actually his second wife, his first wife had died, and he had one daughter in that marriage and one with Sue Bailey. Sue Bailey was a pretty assertive. She was assertive. And she wanted Boston University? I think it was, yes, to give Howard some position, big position, other than the chaplain of Marsh Chapel. And he didn't want that. He wanted to get back to the South. So he wasn't there very long. And I'm not remembering where he went when he went back to the South. Morehouse, maybe, to teach? Yes, thank you for reminding me of that. He did get his PhD at Boston College. University. I mean, sorry, university. There's a Boston College, not to be confused. Yeah. So, anyway, he wrote a lot, always. He always wrote a lot. Something you said reminded me that Thurman was a teacher, an advisor, and or a mentor to Martin Luther King Jr., Marion Wright Adelman, Jesse Jackson, Vernon Jordan. So these were reasons he wanted to go be in the South. And he wasn't someone who was out there in the public eye at all, like King, of course, and Jesse Jackson and so many others. He was definitely there behind the scenes. All right. Thank you all. You'll undoubtedly hear more about Thurman. For me. You can look him up, too. Closing words are, of course, by Howard Thurman. And they're the words that the choir sang this morning, and they're in the back of our hymnal, actually. When the song of angels is stilled, when the star in the sky is gone, when the kings and princes are home, when the shepherds are back with their flock, the work of Christmas begins to find the lost, to heal the broken, to feed the hungry, to release the prisoner, to rebuild the nations, to bring peace among the brothers and sisters, to make music in the heart. May it be so. Go in peace. Greet your neighbor.